This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Bismillah, wassalatu wassalamu ala rasulillah. Assalamu alaikum, everyone. Welcome to the second session of the virtual salon. I am your host, Naima B. Robert, and it is an absolute pleasure to be here with our amazing panelists, mashallah. My panelists today are Sister Rahma Roda, who is an author. I have her down as a mother of three, but she's an author and an activist within the community, mashallah. If you remember her from last week's session, she shared some very, very, very poignant points with us, mashallah. So that's Rahma Roda, all the way from Canada. Then I have Brother Michael Mumisa, who is an academic, hailing from Zimbabwe. He's an academic. He's at Cambridge University, mashallah. And he was also here in our first session. Welcome, Brother Michael. And I also have Buna Muhammad here, a poet, speaker, host, producer, director from Canada, mashallah, and again and again and again. Oh, he also told us last week that he's a Muslim model, but he's not wearing a tashiki today. So, I don't know.
Looking for Brother Mike. I want to borrow Brother Michael's shirt. I like his shirt. I like that style.
Okay, great. Okay, so we'll see if we can organize some kind of sponsorship or something like that, inshallah.
Clothing exchange.
Yeah, exactly. Then I've got Sister Bilkis Quick, who is also with us, mashallah, from Canada. She is an entrepreneur and all the mother of, is it three boys and one girl?
Four boys, mashallah,
and one girl. And mashallah, then I have the two out of the three coaches who, mashallah, graced us with their presence last week. And they are polygyny and relationship coaches based in the States, mashallah. So, guys, just everyone, just give yourself a big wave to the camera, inshallah. It's wonderful to have you here. And bismillah, the reason that we've come together today is to continue these discussions that the virtual salon is for. And these are conversations between thinking people about some of the issues that we care about within the ummah, you know, within our communities. So today we are talking about raising Black Muslim children. We want to look at some of the challenges, some of the issues that have arisen when it comes to identity, belonging, and self-worth. So my first question to the panel is this. Since over the last couple of weeks now, there's been a lot of talk about anti-Blackness within the Muslim community. We mentioned this in session one. And so my question to you is, how do you think, or what do you see is the effect on our Black Muslim children in light of the attitudes that we know to exist within the Muslim community? The floor is open. Bismillah. Guys, take it away.
I mentioned this to you last week. The Canadians have a tendency to be very polite, so we allow everyone else to speak, and then we kind of reflect. But to answer your question, I think many of us have been having this uncomfortable conversation. I'd love to hear from Balqis because she has, mashallah, grown kids, and you as well, Sister Naima. But I think at some point, especially as a Black man, I don't look forward to it, but I understand my responsibility in terms of the day I will have to explain to my son that he is a threat. You know, that's an unfortunate reality that was explained to me indirectly by people that were older than me, but at some point, you have to tell young Black men specifically, society sees you as a threat. You leave your home, and I cannot guarantee your safety any longer. When you go to public school, when you go to the grocery store, whatever you do, when you leave the sanctity of my home, there are people that might look at you in a certain way, and that has real ramifications. I think specifically now, having that conversation with young men and women and young kids and explaining to them that, you know, of course, in your home, you build this bubble of love. And for my kids are still young. My kids are 7 and 5. But my wife and I have been slowly trying to explain to them, you know, why the world is the way it is. And it's really hard to explain to a 5-year-old. I find it difficult to explain to a 5-year-old why someone might hate you without ever having met you, you know. And it's extremely, I guess, difficult to have that conversation. But I think as a responsible parent, you have to set your children up for success. I don't want my kids walking into situations and thinking everything's all good and realizing that it's not. I mean, from day one, my kids have been learning martial arts. My kids are both involved in karate and martial arts. I'm not playing around, you know, like I don't want them to be in a situation where they feel like they're ill-equipped to deal with life's reality. So for me, it's about preparing my children mentally, preparing them physically, giving them the tools they need to succeed. We're not in the U.S., so we don't have the Second Amendment. But if we were, I mean, that's a reality many people have to examine. How do you protect yourself and your family? I think that's something that really, as Black people, you know, we have to be cognizant of.
SubhanAllah, that's deep. I want somebody to jump in there. I'm still processing that, SubhanAllah. Anybody want to jump in?
I think I'll go next. So Bona, my kids are around the same age as yours. I have a daughter that's 8. I have a son that's 5 and a young daughter that's 2. So for me, like I mentioned last time, the first time my daughter encountered visibly discrimination, she was 4. So she didn't have the language to express that she felt excluded, but it was happening, and it happened in front of my face. So I've never shied away about educating my children about, you know, what is happening in the world, the fact that they are different. And my daughter is someone that's very sensitive. She does understand that there are bad things that are happening, but still has this notion that police officers and things like that, they're designated to protect people. So I think that's the hard part, is trying to explain to your children that law enforcement perhaps will not be on their side when we have taught them to call 911 or to call for police officers to protect them. So now how do we explain that police officers will now treat you different because of your skin color? I grew up with one brother, and we lived in Ottawa for a long time, which is the capital of Canada. And when I was around the age of 19, my mother made the decision to actually uproot us and move us to Alberta, where we currently reside. And the reason for that was that we were living in government housing, and there was a lot of violence that was happening in terms of little boys just kind of getting in trouble and things that happen normally in certain communities, and that happened in a lot of different communities as well. And my mother intuitively understood that my brother, even though he might not be someone that would do something violent or something criminal, understood that he could easily be at the wrong place at the wrong time and could be involved in something like that. So she literally made the decision to uproot us and to move us to a province where there was really not much diversity. Like when we came here in Alberta and we enrolled in schools and we were studying in French, we were the only Somali family. So we were like basically the pioneers here when we moved to Edmonton. And we had to go through a lot of growing pains just because we were the only ones. But she felt that it was much safer for us to be the only ones and to be in a community where perhaps we were alone, but isolated, and she felt that was safer, like, you know. And I commend her for the decision that she has made. I do see a lot of the children that we grew up with, and a lot of them have now gone through, you know, the legal system, and where they just petty crimes and things like that. And, you know, we all know that white children get treated differently than are the Black men. So she made a very wise decision. So, I mean, these are all things that we have to think about. And now raising a Black son, it's things that I have to consider. And it's just interesting to see that, you know, my mother had to deal with that, and it's not getting better. It's just, you know, you have to be more aware of it. I've worked in the school system. I know how the administration of schools see our Black children are, you know, they don't have the education to know and to have that type of sympathy to know where they're coming from, how they judge them, how they see them from just being in the administration. So I feel like I have a lot more knowledge than my parents did, and therefore I have a lot more fears than they did, because they just saw the things that were visible, but they don't understand the system as in depth that I do. And therefore I have so much more fears for my children, because I know how everything works. And they say, you know, knowledge is power, but knowledge is also something that can cripple you, because you know how many things can go wrong. So, we just don't have the option of not talking about it. And, you know, when Brother Bona says, you know, you have to equip your kids mentally, physically, and as well emotionally, because they have to be ready to combat this, because it's coming at them. They're basically, I see it as there's no option.
SubhanAllah, so many things I have, but mashallah, Brother Michael has mastered the hand up in Zoom. So I have to give him the mic. There you go, Brother Michael.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. I think what we have to do is really to teach our children to embrace their outsider status, to celebrate that. And I think we all know that, as the Prophet said in one of the most famous tradition, al-Islamu bada'a ghariban. وَسَيَعُودُ غَرِيبًا كَمَا بَدَأَ فَطُوبَ لِلْغُرَبَى. That Islam started as gharib, as strange to many people, as an alienated way of life. And it will once again become gharib, فَطُوبَ لِلْغُرَبَى. So glad tidings to the alienated and the strangers, the outsiders, those on the margins of society. I think this is important, I think, for them to understand that they stand in a long line of people who were considered outsiders right at the very beginning of Islam itself. If you look at the majority of the followers of the Prophet right at the beginning, there were those people who were considered to be on the margins. They were mostly the young people, because in a culture of where seniority really was regarded as being more important than knowledge and your skills and your qualifications. And young people flocked to the message of the Prophet because they saw that as a message that liberated them from that kind of jahili ageism. And then you also had a lot of women who were among the early followers. You had a lot of Black people who had become, you know, the diaspora community in Mecca, including, of course, there were already Arab, Black Arab tribes, but you also had a large number of people who had come from Ethiopia in particular, who became residents of Mecca, and they were among, because of their status as outsiders from the protection of the Arab tribes, they found the new message of Islam as something that would offer them that protection, as something that was, you know, reaching out to the marginalized. And you also had the disabled. You had the former slaves, those who were still slaves at that time. And of course, many of those who had become liberated by Islam, and, you know, some of the famous ones. So these people really became the founders of the Muslim tradition. So when young people, if children really are made to feel as though they do not belong to Islam, they have to be reminded of these stories. As the famous African saying goes, until lions begin to tell their own stories, the story of the hunt will always glorify the hunter. So these stories have to be told, whether it is through, poems like Brother Bona does, or the writing like Sister Naima does with her books. I think that, and also teaching, and that is really important. I think that those are some of the ways through which young people can be given the tools they need to reclaim their place and reclaim their identity in Islam, and for them to understand that Blackness itself has always been part of the cultural and intellectual DNA of Islam. We wouldn't have Tafsir without all those black scholars in the early stages of the development of Islam. We wouldn't have the field of the study of Hadith. We wouldn't have Usul al-Fiqh. We wouldn't have al-Balagha and all the other key disciplines considered to be essential in the study and understanding of Islam. They wouldn't exist without the contribution that was made by the black scholars alongside, of course, Arab scholars who were working at that time, including Persian scholars. Even before the advent of Islam, the Prophet himself had been brought up in a community and a society in which black culture was influential. The Prophet spoke Amatu bintu Khalid, famously known as Ummu Khalid, who was born in Ethiopia. And that's, of course, another story because, as you know, the first migration in the early stages of Islam was to Ethiopia. The Prophet sent his immediate family and others to go and seek refuge in Ethiopia. They settled there for a number of years and some children were born there. So the first born Muslims in the history of Islam were born in Africa, not in Medina. They were born in Africa. So she was among those who were born there, including, of course, some Ethiopians who had embraced Islam. And she returned as a young girl, and she narrates that when she was brought to the Prophet, he spoke to her in some Ethiopian language, which she was familiar with. It's not surprising because he was brought up, as you know, by a black woman after the death of his mother. And he grew up being surrounded by an Arabic language that was saturated with words from various languages, many of which were from African languages. Imam Jalaluddin Suyuti is one of the scholars who has touched on this and has written a lot on the language of the Quran and how that language of the Quran also reflected the influence that Africans, or rather the black culture, had on Arabic society before Islam. And of course, there were many poets, even before Islam, called the Jahili poets, poets in the period before Islam, who were black poets. It was even a genre of poetry in Arabic, which was mostly associated with the black poets. And when the Prophet was growing up, this was part of the education of the day, that you had to learn part of this poetry in the same way that you send children to school these days. A properly educated Arab boy would have memorized a lot of these poems. And if you look in Tirmidhi, the collection of Hadith, or Sunan Abi Dawud, there is a section on the recitation of poetry. If you read those traditions, fortunately, Sunan Abi Dawud, I think it's available in English. The Tirmidhi, I don't think it has yet. It may have been translated in English, but I'm not aware of that. You will find references to a lot of the poems that the Prophet recited inside the masjid after Fajr. And these poems and the poets they discussed, according to the narrators of those traditions, were mostly or predominantly from the pre-Islamic period. And they would be made up of a huge number of poets who were also the Ghribatul Arab, the black Arabs or the black poets who composed poetry in Arabic before Islam. And that became part of his education. And he had his favorite poets as well and favorite poems. One of the narrators who's narrating the traditions says that the Prophet would often ask his companions to recite for him his favorite poems from the pre-Islamic period. And he would continue to tell them to recite until they had recited even 100 verses, or rather 100 poems in one sitting. And these were mostly poems that he considered to be the best of that particular tradition. So this is part of the knowledge that young people need to be provided with, and also for them to understand that Islam really is not an Arab religion, it's not a South Asian religion, it's not an Iranian religion, but it is a religion for the whole Ummah, and that Islam reached Africa, Ethiopia, long before it reached Medina. and long before it reached Karachi and Baghdad and even some parts of Arabia. So there were already Muslims in Ethiopia in particular. And also, I mean, of all the places that the Prophet could have sent his the early followers to seek refuge, he chose an African country to go and settle. They could have sent them somewhere else for many reasons. He chose that particular country. So I think this is important. And the tradition I mentioned on, I think is something that I'm always reminded of, the importance of being an outsider. Being an outsider is something to be celebrated. Sometimes children have to be taught that it's important to stand outside of the circle than being in the circle. Being outside of the circle is a good thing. It's not necessarily a bad thing. That's why we say someone is outstanding, because they, you know, they are not someone who simply blow with the wind. And the tradition that speaks of the Ghuraba, when the Prophet was asked, what do you mean when you say glad tidings be to the Ghuraba or the strangers? And he described, or he defined them as an-nuza'u min al-qaba'il, it means those alienated from society or from their tribe. So those alienated from the tribe or from the community. So in our time today, it is really this the situation where a lot of Black Muslims find themselves. They find that they are alienated from, if they are living within a South Asian, predominantly South Asian community, they are alienated from that community. So they constituted the Ghuraba praised by the Prophet, or if it is an Arab community. And so young people need to know their history, that they are not new to Islam, that Blackness in itself has always been part of the intellectual and cultural DNA of the religion of Islam. And there are so many stories that they can be told, and, you know, to make themselves feel very proud of their place in that faith. Scholars of Islam like Suyuti, starting with, of course, Al-Jahid was the first one to address this issue. What we are discussing right now is nothing new. In the 9th century, Al-Jahid addressed this question and tried to produce works, some of which are available in Arabic, and one has been translated into English, really talking about the contribution of Black people in Islam. And then after him, you had other scholars, but rather prominent among them was Ibn Jawzi, who also wrote a work specifically addressing what he noticed to be deep-rooted anti-Blackness in his society. And then you had others until you reached to Jalaluddin Suyuti, who also did the same. So the fact that these works exist is in itself evidence that anti-Blackness has always been there, and that there were scholars who tried to respond to that anti-Blackness. But we live in a time where scholars are producing that anti-Blackness and disseminating it and demonizing any attempted by Black people in general to liberate themselves from forms of oppression. And what is even sickening about it is that they try to invoke the same tradition that came to liberate people. They try to invoke Islam as a way of denying people their right to fight for their freedom, when we know that, you know, Islam has always been the religion of social justice. No, I could hear some. So I think that's all I can say for now, and I'm sure others would like to maybe contribute to the discussion.
Jazakallah khair, Brother Michael. Thank you so much for that. And there's a lot to unpack there. We're going to have to circle back around. I've got some amazing questions that have come in, some comments as well. Does anybody want to quickly, well, answer the original question, which is, you know, how is the anti-Blackness affecting our children? Because so far in the conversation, we've spoken a lot about raising Black children in the West, in a place where they are seen as dangerous, you know, and we're going to unpack all of that, inshallah, because I've got lots of questions. But specifically, children who are Black and Muslim, I'm interested in your thoughts on what that intersectionality means, because if you have a wider society that stigmatizes you on the basis of your race, and then you have a faith community that is anti-Black in some ways, you know, do we need to create safe spaces for our children, even within the Ummah, as Black children? And this is something that I feel is really a legitimate topic for conversation, because in some of the conversations we've been having about anti-Blackness this week, something that has come up from non-Black Muslims is, we must not divide. We must not divide. We must not divide. We must not divide. You know, if we have a problem, it's the Ummah's problem, and we all need to work together to solve it. But the answer is not for Black Muslims to separate. Coaches have something to say, so I want to hand it over to the coaches. But everybody else, I want to ask you your thoughts on, do Black Muslims need to create safe spaces? Do we need to separate to protect our children? Do we need to have our own books? Do we need to have, you know, our own cultural literature that teaches our children the pride of being not just Muslim, but being a Black Muslim? I want to hear your thoughts. I'm seeing those hands going up. I love this. Yes, coaches, take it away. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Yes, ladies.
I learned something that I want to share as far as that goes. Well, first of all, both of our children have, all of our children have pretty much been online school for years. My youngest daughter just graduated high school from online school. She's been in for 7 years. And her three sisters before her, online school. So it just takes out so much guesswork. You don't have to worry about them being bullied or miseducated, because you know what the homework is and you know how to educate them, because you know what they're learning. To add to that, what I learned from my aunt, she only bought Barbie dolls of color for her daughter. Her daughter's almost 30 years old now. She only bought books with children of color in them. I don't care if they were from Africa. I don't care if they were from the UK, the States, because she was an in-law, so she was married to Coach Nadir's uncle on his Puerto Rican Caribbean side. She said, it's important for my children to see themselves in books and in literature in our home, to see Black people, to see art, to see content that we create all over their home. Because I had little girls. I grew up with a white Barbie doll. And she said, don't ever buy them a white doll. Buy them a doll that looks like them. And I did it ever since. They were very, very young. But she taught me that. Because I think from a young age, especially people that are from my age group, you were taught to hate who you are and how you looked. My daughter, my second oldest daughter, went to school at Bain Institute in Texas, and she was roommates with four girls that were, I think three were Indian and then one was Pakistani. And my daughter's light skin, and they thought she was, of their ethnicity. So their mothers were there speaking their languages to my daughter, my Black daughter. And she's like, I don't understand what you're talking about. I'm not Desi. I'm not Indian. I'm not Pakistani. I'm Black. She still continued to do so, to such a point of being obnoxious. I said, well, to her, Black doesn't look like you. And Black doesn't look like how you look in her mind. I said, but we Black people look all different kinds of ways. And so my daughter, being the 22-year-old introvert, powerful spirit that she is, she bought a t-shirt that was red, black, and green, and it said, I'm Black every day of the month on it. They quit asking her, was she Black after that? I don't want people to mistake it. They think Black is one way. They think Black is... they just have this vision in their mind what we look like, and there's no set vision on what we look like. We make every shade of eye color, of hair color, of skin color. And when my daughters were little, and then I'm gonna pass it to my co-wife, they were in school and they said, well, you're not Muslim at an Arab school. She knows the school I'm talking about here in the Midwest. And my daughter said, why? Yes, I am. She said, no, because your mother's black. They think that Coach Nadir was Egyptian. So, his, you know, you Muslim on that part of you, that side. And I said, you tell me a black mama said you are Muslim. And she did. And that little girl left her alone. So that's my story on that, you know, that it's I hate that it came from the Muslim community, but it did come.
Girl.
Your turn, girl.
Sorry, girl. Sorry. No,
because I like taking notes because there were a number of things that were said, like just through the from the beginning till now. I'm like, okay, wait, let me
hold on.
Don't go actually go back to some people. Like Rathma, she made the comment, you know, Sister Rathma said, knowledge is power. Also, knowledge can, you know, breed, you know, fear and kind of like the stagnant type of thing. And I get that, but we actually state applied knowledge is power. Yes. So you can have all the knowledge you want to. If you're not moving on it, if you're not doing anything positive to it or with it, that's kind of, it's irrelevant. So the thing is, you want to make sure that a couple of things. I like what Brother Buna was talking about as far as preparing your children, because we do the same thing.
Yes,
I mean, it's
indeed.
Like 12 children we are dealing with right here. We said it last week, we're saying like 12 children. So a good portion of them are adults, but they're still children. You know how they go. But the thing is that starting it, just like Brother Michael was talking about, is about knowing your history. Mm-hmm. You know, knowing the history. Yeah. Because the thing is, when you don't know where you came from, when you don't know what your history is about, when you don't know, when you only are fed the thing of like you were slaves or your ancestors were slaves and things like that, and you see 12 years slave, this a slave and another a slave and all these slaves, and that's all you were ever slaves. It's like, okay, I don't want to be part of that. I don't want, you know, you have kids that don't see the strength and the fight and all that other stuff. But to start looking at, it's more than that. There are kings and queens and all of this other stuff, and knowing the history behind it and teaching your children at a young age how they can understand in a way that they can understand. So to answer the one question that talked about, should we have our own books, our own teachers, our own, yes, definitely yes. Everybody because then says. We know that it's not going to get skewed into a way where it makes this one person or this one group of people look superior when all it is masking or trying to sweep other things under the rug that, you know, that caused them fear to begin with, fear of looking inferior and, you know, and greed and all this other stuff. So we know the history, we know the stuff, but being able to teach our children that stuff, being able to teach our children at a young age. And that's the thing, what we do with our children. It's like, okay, we teach them the power. We teach them the history that they have and where they come from. The one other thing, like I said, I took a couple of notes because it was some good stuff. Delaying, someone put a question in the chat asked about delaying children from being in like the public system or something on the lines and all. Is that a way to protect? The thing is this, it's not about delaying them in the public system, because whether they're in the school system or whether they're not involved in the school system, they're still going to encounter this stuff regardless. My oldest will be 21. And the reason why I took him out, and like my co-wife said, we virtual school, homeschool, we've done that stuff for years. It wasn't necessarily, my decision wasn't necessarily to say, you know what, let me protect him from, you know, what's going on and everything like that. My reason was that they weren't teaching him the stuff that he needed to know, and they weren't allowing him to grow. When he wanted to move forward, they were still on the same thing. So in order to, when he was antsy because he was bored, they labeled him as having ADHD or all this other stuff. So it's these different things where we see in the school systems or in the public system that you have to be like them or do the things like that way. And if you don't, then there's something wrong with you. But when you take control as a parent and say, you know what, this is what I'm going to teach my child. This is how I'm going to teach my child, because I'm going to arm them and prepare them with the things that they need in order to be out here in the world. And it doesn't matter if they start, if they went to a public school or not, it's still our job as parents to teach them. It's not about just taking them away from something. It's arming them with the knowledge and the know-how of how to delegate and how to just go out there and know what they're about, know where they come from, you know the being able to separate the lies from the truth and all that other good stuff. But it starts at a young age, and you continue to build on that and lead by example. So we have to continue to increase our knowledge as well. We have to continue to increase our self-esteem, our self-awareness, so we are able to teach our children the same.
Yes, I thank you so much for that. I mean, so much good stuff there. Nice, guys. Oh, everybody wants to know, do the coaches have any lectures that they can go and listen to, mashallah? Guys, follow them on Instagram. They're at Outstanding Relationships, okay? And, oh, there's more stuff. What's that? Hold on, let me just get that. Spotlight that video. Oh, there's a book. Okay, guys, you heard it here first, mashallah. Okay, so there is so much there. I'm not even going to say anything because Sister Bukhisa has been waiting. So I'm going to give it to her. Then Buna's hand shot up. And so I want to hear about that. And just those of you who are on social media, those of you who are tweeting or who are updating Instagram, I really think that what the sister said about taking control of our children's education and their tanbiyah is huge. And it doesn't depend on, as what the sister was saying, it doesn't depend on them being removed from the school system per se, or whether they're in Islamic school or they're not. It's still our responsibility to make sure to ensure that they have the knowledge that they need. And that's a point I'd like to go to, because we've talked about preparing them for the worst, right? We've talked about, unfortunately, letting them know that it's not going to be, you know, all strawberries and cream, and that there are going to be people who hate them. And for me, that is very problematic for me, okay? So I'm not gonna say anything. We're gonna come back to that. And I'm gonna go to Bilkis and then Brother Buna, and then Brother Michael's hand was up as well. Go ahead, sis.
So this has been a very long struggle for me. Just even starting back with my brothers. So myself and I have four brothers. We're second generation Muslims and living in Canada. And I feel like in Canada, there's like a little bit of a different scene for Afro-American, Afro-Caribbean Muslims, because the community or the amount is very small, right? And especially back when we were growing up here, it was like even smaller. So just to try to keep yourself in having like an Islamic identity, or, you know, my parents, like my dad's a historian, African history. And so for us, he was able to teach us about, you know, the history of Islam in Africa. And so that's kind of how we grew up. So we kind of had like it was sort of a strange kind of culture that we created in our family, because it was like a hodgepodge of all different sorts of, you know, Islamic cultures put together to kind of, and then on top of it, we're Western. So we have like, you know, my mother's Jamaican. So we had a bit of Jamaican thing going on and an American, you know, Bostonian sort of thing going on. So it was just like this kind of culture that we kind of grew up in. But now to the next generation and my children, I'm not my parents. And so I grew up in the Canadian system, this Canadian school system. And I watched my brothers in the Canadian school system being Black boys, and just how it was completely out here to destroy them, like completely. And so, you know, just you know, when I started having children, and it was, you know, I gave birth to one male and then another male and then another male, and, you know, and, you know, just realizing what I had to do, the responsibility that I had, you know, to these children. And so I had decided from just the very beginning to homeschool them. And that was one of the main reasons why I decided to homeschool, was to protect them, basically from the system. And then, you know, just kind of including the kind of things that I learned as a child or the way I grew up. I taught them when, you know, when it came to teaching history, I taught them Islamic history alongside African history. Like, it was a joint sort of lesson from a very young age. So, you know, they studied Great Kings of Africa, you know, and you know, at that time there was the new poster of the Great Kings of Africa. It was like amazing. If you guys haven't seen them, they're just so beautiful. Maybe Google it or something, but so just, you know, those two things came together as one. And I had to make that personal decision myself, because being in the community that I was in, predominantly South Asian, you know, and then also the homeschooling community that I was in, which was also predominantly South Asian, and just, you know, everyone discussing the curriculum that they were using. And, you know, I just had to decide on my own what I needed to teach my children, right? And that was really just to try to develop their self-worth and self-confidence in their, and because I knew what was coming, right? I knew what was coming. And then as well to just giving them defense against the Muslim community. And that's like a horrible, horrible thing to say, but that just was the reality of it, you know, like giving them, you know, the armor. So when they go out there, you know, and the kind of the racism that we're going to experience from the Muslim community. You know, this has been like years and years and years of struggle for me. And now my eldest is almost 24, mashallah. And, you know, the you know, like the sisters are saying, the range of colors in your family, the hues of blackness also coming into play. My eldest son is very, very light-skinned. He's light-skinned as, you know, more light-skinned than anyone, okay? So to the point that people think that he is mixed, like some parent is white, right? And then, you know, going towards, you know, my third son, who is a dark-skinned, who's dark-skinned. So it was just trying to navigate that as well, and as well in the Muslim community and the way that people treated each child because of the color of their skin, and literally the color of their skin, you know, and, you know, just them trying to navigate through that. And I feel like, you know, the issue right now for me is, you know, them being young adults is just trying to, you know, they know the history, they know basic history. I mean, there's a lot of things that are being uncovered right now that have been hidden from us from the whole Muslim world, like Brother Michael was mentioning, all of that information, you know, that has been hidden. So there's that, but then trying to get them to feel that it's important to actually learn that now, because of the damage that has been done to them in the Muslim community, you know, like to pull them back in and really, like, this is you know, they know that Islam is between them and Allah. Ultimately, that's it, right? It's between you and Allah, and you know, day of judgment, you're going to be answering to Allah for your own deeds. So they've got that. But then the community aspect of Islam is also very important, you know? And so to pull them back into the Muslim community and say, you know what? It's okay. You've been treated this way, whatever, whatever. But, you know, to make it safe again, you know, and they're just sick and tired of being the teachers, you know, like, this is not how you're supposed to treat Black people, you know, when you go out to the rest of the world, this is not how you're supposed to, you know, be treating Black people. And, you know, they just don't feel very comfortable. And now, because of, you know, this whole insurgence, like, you know, even before the murder of George Floyd and them really coming into themselves as males, like Black males, and paying attention and listening and knowing what is happening out there, and them just now saying, you know what, I'm going to identify as a Black male, you know, and they haven't taken on any of the clothing of, you know, the other parts of the world, Islamic world. So they're dressing like a Westerner, right? Mm-hmm. So they're so now it's like they're identifying as a Black male. And so to identify as a Black male, they are now looking more Western. Mm-hmm. Now it's, you know, mm-hmm. there's this whole dynamics about how Western, you know, what the brother was saying, stranger, how strange do you want to be? Like, it's the whole thing. It's.
And where do you want to be strange? Like, if you have to choose where you're going to be strange and where you're going to stand out, which community are you going to be okay being alienated from?
Yeah.
You know, and I think that, thank you so much, Sister Bukis, because I think that tension, especially at times like this, between your race and especially, as you said, you know, Black boys out there, you know, that the tension of living that reality, and then also kind of being part of a faith community where, you know, you maybe don't necessarily feel like you belong, you don't feel like you're accepted or you know, respected. I think it's not even about acceptance or tolerance. I think for me, it's about respect. But anyway, I'm not here to do the talking. So I'm going to go to, can I go to Bona, then Michael, then Rahma? Go ahead, guys, unmute yourselves. And inshallah, what we'll do, because I don't want today to go 3 hours like it did last time. So what we can do, inshallah, is once we've kind of done this, we've got lots of questions that are coming up from the audience and I'm sure amongst ourselves. What we can do is we can try unmuting and having like a dialogue across the panel, inshallah, okay? Bona, go ahead.
I don't want to be controversial, but I want to kind of...
It's okay, be controversial. Bring it.
I want to spice it up a little bit, all right? Put it that way. Because I think that as Black Muslims, there's also a level of romanticizing that occurs when we talk about creating Black safe spaces, right? Hmm. I think maybe Sister Rahma can agree with me. In certain communities, in the East African communities, right, there are certain people who would not be welcomed, although we would consider them to be Black, right? That's just an obvious truth. That's not something that, you know, you can lie about or whatever. So we have in Canada and Toronto, and I'm sure in Alberta and other places, you know, you'll have Black, quote unquote, masajid. You'll have, but they're ethnic based, right? You'll have a Somali masjid, you'll have Oromo masjid, Ethiopian masjid, whatever. And these are Black spaces, but in many, and the vast majority of these times, other ethnic groups, other ethnicities, other people, even though they may look like us, they're not valued or respected. Mm-hmm. And I think Black is such a beautiful term, but for me, it's a unifying term, right? It's a term that brings people together, despite our own nuances, our own differences. But it always reminds me of, when I think of the word Black, I always think of like how beautiful and important the overall legacy is, people who are, you know, coming from Africa. But there are so many Black people who don't realize they're Black, and they are gatekeepers to these spaces. And it's almost impossible to get them all on the same board, like get them all on board on the same time, right? Like, it always reminds me of the quote of Harriet Tubman. I don't know if it's authentic or not. I don't know if we can, if there's an Senate for Harriet Tubman.
What's the Isnad, brother?
Yeah, the Isnad, I don't know. But one of the statements that's attributed to Harriet Tubman, where she said, you know, she freed thousands of slaves, and she could have freed thousands of more if they only realized they were slaves, right?
Oh, somebody do something with that quote, please.
There are so many people that I wish as a community I could reach out to and explain to them and prep their children, prep them and their families for what's coming to them. But they're just not, they think Black people are them. No, Black people is that. Those are Black people. And you look in the mirror and you're like, what am I? You know, I'm from, my parents are from Ethiopia. My wife is Eritrean, right? What does that make my kids? Mm. Confused, right? They're just born in Canada. They don't have a particular, myself and my wife are not cultural. Mm. We don't have like a particular culture that we identify with. And so growing up, our identities are much more in flux with being Black and being, you know, this kind of pan-Afro perspective on the fact that we embrace all types of Blackness. But I would go on a limb and say that's not the experience of the vast majority of Black people who are not necessarily my age. I'm talking about parents and older, right? I think the younger folks may be having younger children, that may be different. But I think that's something to be cognizant of, because I think many times we romanticize this notion of Black spaces. I'm responding to that statement earlier. Should we have our own spaces? I don't know if we can have Black spaces that are not ethnically divided. I don't know if it's possible. I don't know if you can have a space where everyone is Black and everyone feels that we're all the same, that all of our experiences, because I think that sometimes can be detrimental, because it's also erasing our own individual experiences and identities, right? I'm not African American, and African Americans have unique experiences and histories and cultures that we shouldn't just erase and say, okay, yeah. No, you're like us now, you're African, or you're from this. No, you have your own, I have my own cultural baggage, everyone has their own cultural baggage, and I don't necessarily think we need to minimize or erase those. That's why I've always taken the approach, and this is where the controversy lies. This is why I wanted to spice it up a little bit. But I think in terms of really creating Black-only spaces, is it more important? And I don't dismiss the work of anyone, by the way. I think it's not a matter of this or that. I think everyone should be doing something, right? I'm not saying you have to do what I'm doing. I'm saying do something. I always take the approach of taking Islamic spaces and making them more relevant to diversity and the Black Muslim experience and other experiences as well. Because I think that, I'll give you the example of my Muslim Students Association. In the UK, you call them ISOCs, right? I went to a university, I had a Muslim Students Association that was like 100% Desi, like 100% Indian, right? But you know, there's a lot of Black Muslims that go to the school. So you'd go to Jummah, you go to all these, and they put on events, and we would just be like, this is whack. Like, we, you know, these people are out of touch. And so now, actually, ironically enough, there's a movement in the US, which I definitely, you know, I vibe with, where there are Black Muslim Students Associations, which I think is cool. It's a great alternative. But in my day, they didn't have that. So what I did was that I said, well, look, I want to join this organization. I want to basically, and I did. I joined the organization. I became the vice president, whatever. And I started making it more accessible to Black students. And then eventually more students started showing up. We had, you know, a lot more diversity throughout the ranks. And I think to me that creates a more organic culture of unity amongst the ummah. You know, a lot of people will say this, don't divide, don't divide. I don't think we're the ones doing the dividing. I don't think it's a response to what's already been divided. It's not Black people are saying, well, we don't want to be with you guys. It's you're saying you don't want to be with us. So we got to figure out, where do we go? Right.
It's kind of, would you say, when I started to jump in there, say that it's like, it's not even so much, we don't want you here, but it's more like, we'll tolerate you here. Like, it's okay. Like, you can come, but we're still going to have biryani, and all the sheikhs are going to be, you know, one from one background. And
yeah,
the way that we will approach things is going to be our way, because we're the dominant culture. But you can come, like, it's okay. You know, but I feel like, just to what you were saying about the different groups, would you say then that the future generations will have a much more Black or Pan-African approach due to the watering down of culture and the loss of culture and the intermarriage, and also the fact that functionally, I feel, when we are in the West, we become Black by default because we are the other and the white gaze is on us, right? As far as white people are concerned, we're just Black. They don't care about, you know, your tribe or your country or your nation. Would you say then that the next generations maybe will be free to just be Black or just be Pan-African or whatever? What do you
think? Well, I think this is what I kind of alluded to this last week, because I do believe that future generations will eventually improve upon, you know, the foundations that have been laid before us. I love the fact that, you know, Bilqis's children, you know, they're what is it, third generation now, and you have my children now who are, you know, second generation Canadians, and when you get old enough, when these kids start looking at each other, they're not going to see anything else. It's not going to be, well, your family's from your one quarter this, one quarter that. Now we're going to start talking in quarters. It's not even, you know, you're half this, you're half that. You're 1/15th. We're going to be like the white people we have here who are 1/17th Welsh, 1/18th Scottish. It's like, you're just white, right?
Yeah.
But for us, I think we need to have a more holistic approach to creating safe spaces. I don't think it should be just Black spaces where we, and I agree, there's times, and especially in our day, there are times when we need to be amongst each other to just give each other that boost. You know, it's hard to be in spaces where you're not recognized, where you're not respected. But I think ultimately change cannot happen unless it's done at a leadership level. I don't care about the demographic of your masjid. I'm worried about the leadership. I want to know who's in charge. I want to know what spaces on your board have been reserved for people outside of your ethnic group. I want to know who are the people that are calling the shots. I think we need to stop worrying about the minuscule things, and we need to start looking at the bigger pictures, right? Because there are people that are calling the shots. Once you become a shot caller, you can change that culture and tradition. Mm-hmm. But many of us, we kind of look back and we say, well, you know, I don't like this organization. I don't like that masjid. What? Okay, you don't like it. Fix it. Let's and it's not easy. This is not me minimizing the effort and saying, you know, just go ahead and do it. But I feel like it's to the betterment of everyone if we take that approach. But again, it's not just this approach. I think there has to be a variety of approaches. There has to be some black safe spaces where people can go and recharge and feel loved and feel valued. Then there has to be times when we are able to go into the public sphere and the public Muslim sphere and really wreak havoc and take those spaces and make them like our own.
Yeah, I stand up. No, 100%. Anybody who disagrees, guys, I really would like it to be a safe space for anybody to just be like, no. So if you want to respond to something specifically to what someone has said right then and there of the panel, please like make a sign in your video so that I can so that I know that you want
to
come in.
And bring it on, by the way. I want people to disagree. I think we were all kind of singing Kumbaya for a second, so I was like, let's spice it up a little bit, you know.
Bona is here. It's from the streets, boy. He's bringing it. He's just like, yeah, okay, let's rouse some rebels. Okay, Brother Michael, yes.
Yes, I think I'll really echo a lot of what Brother Bona has said, and to say that this is exactly what the Prophet was trying to do. The masjid of the Prophet was that safe space for black people. We know from the traditions in Bukhari and others that African performers came to the masjid to perform, playing drums and singing their war songs and dancing, you know, dancing in the presence of the Prophet. Today, you're not even welcome to pray in a mosque as a black person. And yet the Prophet welcomed them to come and dance in the mosque.
But Brother Michael, can I just jump in there to say as well that although they may not like you to come and pray, they have no problem with us coming to perform at the fundraiser and do the sheets and rap and poetry so that they can take money to send to Afghanistan and Palestine and Kashmir and Musharrafi. So just to spice that.
Well, yes, it's very important. I think that's an important point. And then the other question was, what should parents do? And I think parents' first responsibility is towards their children, to protect their children. Even in the Quran and Sunnah, it is not your responsibility. It's not your first responsibility as a parent to rather protect the symbols of religion. That's why when a child is crying there, you can break your salah and go and look after a child. And all the fiqh we have, I don't want to go into that. So that's important. So if your children are being abused in a madrasa or are being made to feel that they don't belong, or you are concerned for their mental health, and you are concerned even for their deen, that they may be made to hate themselves and also to hate that religion, that faith, then of course you can, I think, protect your children from that kind of environment. But that environment is harmful. And there is an important principle in Islamic fiqh shared by all Muslims, regardless of their madhab, whether they're Salafi, Shafi'i, Shi'i, whatever the school of thought they belong to, they subscribe to this principle that la darar wa la dirar fil Islam, that Islam came, which is based on a tradition from the Prophet, where he said that there shall be no harm to yourself and harm to others in Islam. So this is one of the fundamental principles of Islamic law, that there shall be no harm to self and to others. And that harm can be physical harm, or it can be mental harm, psychological harm. So Islam came to stop that and prevent all that from happening. So if a certain space, even if it is a religious space, once it starts to cultivate a culture which really causes a lot of people harm, mental harm and physical harm, then it ceases to be an Islamic space. And the Prophet in the Quran, the term zirar, which is mentioned in this tradition, is also mentioned in the Quran, in the in the case of that masjid, which was destroyed by the Prophet, Masjid Dhirar, the masjid which had been established to cause this kind of, to cause people a lot of harm. And that was not physical harm at that time. It was the kind of things we're talking about. At that time, it may have been something different, but the mental and the harm that it was doing to people's iman as well as to their mental health was so serious that the Prophet ordered that it be destroyed. Hmm. And that's one thing we have to, of course, this is not to suggest that people, do anything extreme. That was the Prophet. What the point I'm trying to underscore here is that a space is only Islamic if it doesn't cause harm to others. Mm. If it causes harm, it's not an Islamic space. Then you have to create an Islamic space. Mm. If it's causing dirar and to others or dharar to yourself when you go there, it causes you dharar in the sense that what you are learning from there is making you doubt your faith. You are being taught a lot of horrible things about black people, for example. You are listening to racist khutbas, or you are being given racist tafsir. That does happen. Racist commentaries of the Quran do exist. And people have even gone as far as fabricating tradition, racist traditions, and attributing them to the Prophet. And I think I mentioned before.
Touched on those last week, yes.
Exactly, exactly. They do. So if you're going to a mosque like that and you're hearing this thing, it's causing you harm, and the mosque itself is causing dhirar, right? So it is, I think, what you have to do is to find a way of solving that problem. Of course, you take your context into consideration. It may be that you may have to remove whoever is in charge. There are ways of removing the trustees, but we have organizations in this country, in the United Kingdom, whose written constitutions clearly stipulate that only a member of a certain ethnicity, from that community can be elected to the committee or can take a senior position in the mosque. Mm-hmm. So if you have that as a constitution, what can you do about it? And then some may not have these explicitly written in their constitutions, but it is an unwritten law in that particular community. So you'd be wasting your time, causing yourself a lot of problem by trying to change something that cannot be changed. Sometimes you just have to look into the examples of the Sahabas, what they did. Look at, we know from history that copies of the Quran were destroyed because they were causing dirar, because the Sahabas wanted to have a unifying, copies, because there's so many different versions. People had written some commentaries in their own copies, keeping them under a mattress, according to some of the tradition of Aisha, for example. And so they had all these extra commentaries, and their children were getting confused. They couldn't tell the difference between a verse of the Quran and a commentary inserted in that. They were starting to say that, well, this is part of the Quran, when actually it was just a commentary. Now you have a situation where racist commentaries do exist. So if you have your children going to a mosque and then getting access to these kind of commentaries, of course that caused them harm. So I think parents can just decide what to do with this. And just a few more points which were raised. The other question was, should black people have their own books? I think for early Muslims, early black Muslims, their book was the Quran. And they came to Islam, as I said, because they saw it as a book that was liberating them from their situation. And the teachings of the Prophet was, especially in the form of hadith, became that book for them that would liberate them. But of course, at some point in history, you had the fiqhis and other commentaries of the same Quran produced to oppress black people, especially in areas to do with slavery and so forth and so on. So then again, you have a problem here where you have the Quran, which is a liberating document, but commentaries of that Quran are oppressive commentaries. Not all of them, of course, some of them, which were produced by people who had, different agendas. So the Quran can be that book that Muslims should reclaim. I think all Muslims, whatever their ethnicities, it is their document. For black people in particular, it is their document, and it's demonstrated in the history. Then you have books which were written specifically for black people. The tradition of writing books for black people is not new. it started with Al-Jahid in particular, and then I gave example Ibn Jawzi. There were many others. I'm simply giving examples of the most famous works available. Suyuti and others wrote these books. And of course, you had Ibn Maruzban is writing in the introduction to one of his works that his friends, he was Persian himself, but he said his friends were already talking, black scholars in Iraq in the Abbasid period, were already talking that they needed to produce more works to reflect their experiences. But what was happening in the writing of the production of knowledge is that it was based on patronage. So you could be able, you could only write and maybe do a lot of teaching if you were being paid by the caliph or some of the elites. So if you were already a marginalized community, then it made it difficult for you to combine whatever you were doing and also while producing works, yes.
I feel like you've opened a big can of worms there. Rahma, I want you to unmute, please, because I feel like that issue of patronage and, you know, being from a marginalized community and producing cultural artifacts for that community and the difficulties of, you know, if you choose to write something for Muslim children, but you choose to have it with black Muslim children characters, now you lose the mainstream appeal of your original work, right? So we are definitely going to have another session, inshallah, talking about cultural creation and cultural artifacts, etc. But Rahma, you've been wanting to speak. Thank you so much, Brother Michael. Go ahead, Rahma.
Okay, thank you. So the first thing I wanted to mention, I think your original question was, is it important to create safe spaces? The way that I see this, and one of the reasons that led me to write the books that I do, is that I see our blackness being attacked at both fronts. I see our blackness is being attacked when it comes to mainstream, with the from, you know, just normal society, being black people. And I see our blackness also being attacked in our Muslim community, where we are made to feel less than. So for me, when I am bringing up my children, I've made the decision to enroll my children in Islamic school so that they wouldn't have to explain their religion. However, I see now that this is the second year of Islamic school for my daughter, and I see some of the problems of parents that chose to enroll their children in public schools. And that's because the pain that can come from experiencing racism when it comes from your own community. So now I am having to shift that and strongly considering doing homeschooling or distance learning, simply because I need to have children that understand this concept, like Brother Michael has said, the concept of being the outsider, how it is okay. I am a product of this society. The programming that has been indoctrinated in me is taking me so many years out of school to kind of unprogram myself, to understand that I don't need to make myself small. I don't need to make myself in a certain way, not to be perceived a certain way. So I don't want my children to go over, like, you know, to kind of, it's as if almost I'm putting them into a system and then expecting them to learn something that's different later on. So why would I even put them in a system that is ill-equipped to teach them what they need in order to survive in the society? So when I hear Brother Michael talking about children needing to learn their history, they're not doing that. Even in the Islamic schools, it's not happening. They do have components of Islamic teaching. However, the African, like, you know, history is not being taught. They, even though my children are among a diverse population, and it is, mashallah, beautiful to see a Muslim community, they're still a minority when it comes to that. So it is really upon yourself to take that ownership of your children's education and build that foundation from the start, so that they can in the future be able to take those actions that Brother Bona has mentioned, to create safe spaces and things like that. I think initially, for me, it's important to create a safe space for them to safeguard their blackness, because it's being attacked in both sides. So that's it's for me to raise children that is that understand that. And then I believe that if we are able to do that, then we're able to send children out there that understands the need for diversity and inclusion in all spaces, especially when it comes to our religious spaces. But if we don't do that and safeguard their emotion and their mental wellness by protecting their Blackness and their identity from the start, it will be very difficult for them to go ahead and you know, do the things that we have mentioned. In my household, we have Black, you know, dolls. I have a doll right here. I mean, making sure that, you know, my daughters, they have to see themselves, whether it be in the books, whether it be in the toys, in every single thing that we introduce, making sure that they are featured and they are celebrated. And this is the reason why I chose to write Muslim children's books that have African features. They have to have African features because the other ones don't. Mm-hmm.
If you enjoyed this conversation and you would like to become part of the virtual salon family, consider becoming a patron. From just £5 a month, you can get access to our chat community, to be invited to our live sessions, and get exclusive content that we only create for our patrons. Be part of the movement. Sign up on Patreon today.